Bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting.
And welcome to the web show on the British Tech Network. I'm Paul Wheatley, and I am here this evening with a fantastic panel to talk about the user experience of, well, predominantly the web, but probably end up drifting into mobile and all things digital. For this, we've assembled a crack team of UX experts, starting with Chris Rourke. How are you this evening, Chris?
I'm very well, Paul. Thank you.
Good, good. You had a good day?
Yeah, busy, but good.
Good, good. Always good. Now, Chris describes himself as a displaced American, a managing director of User Vision, UX and usability consultancy, that's at User Vision on Twitter, a proud dad, a frequent traveller, and your C. Rourke on Twitter, C-R-O-U-R-K-E. Does that kind of sum you up?
Yeah, that's me on Twitter, and yes, that's me.
Yeah, good, good. And next we have Richard Shepherd. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm very good, very good. It's very warm tonight. I have to keep all the windows closed because I live right next to a main road. So it's getting quite toasty in my office at the moment. But
don't start getting undressed.
No, we'll keep that for another show. It's fine. And finally this evening, we have Laura Feely. How are you this evening, Laura?
I'm very well. Thank you, Paul.
Good, good, good. This is your first podcast, first experience into podcasting, is it?
It is indeed. Yeah. My first deal into it.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Of course. I right now deal with all the online optimization, usability, user experience right now for a large health insurance company here in the UK. They're actually global, but we look after the UK site.
Cool. Okay. Sorry, I just remembered Richard there. I didn't actually cover what you do. So you're a front-end lead at Voucher Codes, is that right?
Yeah, I'm the front-end lead at vouchercodes.co.uk. So anything to do with the front-end usually passes past me in some form or another. So whether that's design or development or UX, I try and stick my nose in as much as I can.
Yeah, no, I saw a really good talk, Richard. I saw your talk at the Future of Web Design. And actually prompted me to go away and buy the customer experience of Disneyland book. I can't remember the exact name of it.
Be Our Guest.
Be Our Guest, yes, yeah, yeah.
We
actually used those things in a presentation that we did internally, the 10 Rules of Mickey. 10 Laws of Mickey.
That's very good.
So straight on into the topic. So normally what I do is I try and find a bit of an explanation around the topic, so a bit of an introduction to it. So I kind of found this passage that'll just kind of get us kicked off. So user experience, or UX, is the way a person feels about a product, system, or service. The user experience highlights the experimental, effective, meaningful, and valuable aspects of human-computer interaction and product ownership. But it also includes a person's perceptions of the practical aspects, such as utility, ease of use, and efficiency of the system. User experience is subjective in nature because it's about an individual's feelings and thoughts about the system. User experience is dynamic because it changes over time and circumstances change. Now, there's a little bit of a long-winded way of saying just kind of makes it a little bit easier for the customer, isn't it?
I think that's probably quite an unusable description of usability. I would say, yeah, it's all just making things easier for people, whether it be an interaction, whether it be a service. It's just all about making things that bit easier, more intuitive for the customer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think as well, it's also about how does it make you feel? I think, you know, the key word there is experience, and it's how does using a particular website or web app make you feel, and how does that feeling influence how you interact with the app and how you may go on to recommend that app to someone else.
And I'm sure at some point we'll cover if there's a distinction between usability and user experience. And I think there is. A traditional definition of usability as a term coming from certain standards like ISO 13407 or 9241 would be all about the effectiveness, efficiency, and satisfaction which people have in achieving their goals in particular environments. And that used to be the standard go-to definition. But as things have moved towards user experience, it's a bit more than that. You can be effective and efficient. It's the satisfying and beyond that satisfying that defines the user experience. And that's really where it gets very interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, you kind of mentioned it there, but there's user experience has almost kind of become this bit of buzzword. It's a bit of a catch-all, and it kind of encompasses everything. So somebody's a user experience designer, a user experience specialist, but it doesn't really mean anything. It's kind of more digging down into that usability thing. Is that what you're kind of meaning there?
No, I was just thinking more like we used to use the word usability a lot more than we do now. In fact, the UPA, Usability Professionals Association, has changed its name to the User Experience Professionals Association a few months ago. Is the biggest reflection of that. It's usability on its own is not enough. It's sometimes a bit too black and white a definition, because sometimes people would look at it, well, if you can use it, can you step through this process and find your information? Well, you can, great, then it must be usable. And that's far too blunt a definition. You can, you know, find the information but have a bad time doing it and it's not usable. So I think in the past 5 or so years, we've been searching to try and explore these nuances beyond usability per se. And user experience is the best, I think, best commonly agreed term that we use now to try and just, you know, show that it's not just, is it usable? And that's fairly black and white. But what about all those other things to persuade the user, remove their fears? All of those things are more in the realm of user experience rather than usability.
Yeah, there was a great talk by Aaron Walter, who's the UX lead at MailChimp, at Future Web Design a couple of years ago. And the way he explained it was, imagine you're going out for a meal. Usability is the same as saying the food is edible. You know, you can eat it and it satisfies your hunger, but it doesn't tell you anything about the experience of eating that food. Was it pleasurable? What were the flavors like? What did it make you think of? So it's about taking websites and web applications beyond it's merely usable, it's merely functional. Those are kind of the base levels now, and moving it into a new realm of pleasurability, where you actually can enjoy doing that. And then there's, of course, the science and the business of why it being pleasurable to use actually has a positive impact for you and your business as well.
I think Richard makes a really interesting point there, and I think it's almost, you can see this the way that businesses are now structuring their organization, that you now see, whereas usability, there used to be one person, you know, sitting in the back of the room who's sometimes a web developer who could do a bit of usability. Now you see whole teams of user experience people in their own right. So it's almost, it's not like a marketing function, it's not an operational function, it's a thing in its own right that is vital for getting conversions right, for improving your how your customer feels about your product, about your service.
Yes, and yeah, it is definitely not something that can be easily defined. There's no recipe book, although there's plenty of good books, and we'll talk about them later, about what makes good user experience and good usability. There isn't a simple answer, just due to the variety of users out there, the variety of different types of websites and domains that you're dealing with. It's a bit different than, you know, the cousin of usability could be accessibility, where in a way that is a lot more technically defined, you know, by the coding and all that. And you, to a degree, can automatically define and find a lot of the accessibility problems, certainly not all of them. With usability, it's a lot harder to do that. You have to get a lot more sort of real empirical evidence and things like usability testing, etc.
I was just going to ask your opinion on there was quite a famous, I think it was a tweet from Ryan Carson a year or two ago, where he said UX professional is a BS job title. User experience should be part of everyone's work, whether you're a web designer, a web developer, a product specialist, and so on. And it caused quite a bit of controversy when he said it. I just wondered what your reaction was to that, whether you thought it should be part of everyone's role in a business, or it should be siloed off into a specific area.
I think I've got quite a strong opinion on that, simply because I think when it becomes everyone's responsibility, it ends up becoming nobody's, that no one actually takes accountability for it. Nobody actually puts their hand up and say, hey, I am looking at this. This is what my focus is on. And then you end up getting a little bit here, a little bit there, as opposed to kind of looking at the holistic picture. So often you'll get maybe the front end person looking at just the front end side of the website, and then you'll have someone who focuses on the back end and they'll just look at that. And they'll not look at the entire customer experience. They won't look at it as a user does. So I would say that I would disagree with that quite strongly and say that I think that having somebody or a group of people dedicated to looking at the holistic, the big picture, and whether that be an internal, you know, resource or whether that be bringing in an external resource like a consultancy to look at that and get that kind of fresh pair of new eyes looking at that holistic experience, then I don't think you get as many benefits as you possibly could.
Yeah, I think it's kind of somewhere in the middle. I think everybody has to kind of take an element of responsibility for it, but I think it should, as Laura says, you do get that kind of holistic, right over the top view of it. But if everybody kind of keeps it in the back of their mind for their everyday, and also I think in kind of smaller companies, and this is kind of going away from the digital side of things, I think the customer experience, going back to what you were mentioning there, Richard, with you can go out for dinner and you know, is it edible, does it fill you up, that's grand, but was it nice? I think there's a lot of smaller companies who, you know, aren't of a size that require a single user experience person, both in terms of their website and their general customer experience in their face-to-face. They forget that kind of thing. So I think everybody has to be cognizant of it. Companies who can afford to have a person that will deal with it at a holistic level, then definitely they should do. But I know that sounds like a little bit of a, you know, Switzerland standing on the fence type of answer, but I think you kind of have to kind of have both sides of that.
I think everyone has different capacities to empathize with the end users. You know, we've all got different skills. Some people are very technically oriented, and their interest or capacity to empathize with the end users might be a bit more diminished compared to others. And so, yeah, you know, everyone should have an interest in it, but you definitely should be gravitating that responsibility towards those who definitely have the empathy of the end users, but also the skills to investigate that with the end users, and also know about this huge variety of tools and tips and tricks and design guidelines and patterns and all these things that the UX professional should have up their sleeve. Mm-hmm.
So how do we then go and sell this into a company? So we could kind of take this from two sides here. So one side is that we need to actually hire people in to do it, and another side is maybe going out to an agency to do it. But how do we sell user experience and user testing and usability and all that kind of rich stuff into the stakeholders of the business?
Okay. It's not easy. I think it's like one of these things you have to make them recognize that you have a problem. It sounds like the first of the 12 steps or something. But a lot of the times people don't realize that, you know, what is usability and why do I need it? Or they have these misconceptions. Oh, are you the ones that actually make it look really nice? And know that you're probably thinking more like a graphic designer, perhaps. Yeah. So you need to sort of dispel these misconceptions and then ask them the problem. You know, some key questions that I often ask people, or statements I'll often ask, is, how well do you know your end users? Oh, well, we've had a market research survey that shows that 20% are ABC ones. No, not the demographics, but, you know, how well do they get on with using your site and service? And it might be hearsay through a salesman or, you know, something like that. So it's getting them to admit these gaps in their knowledge. Another area where they'll say, well, I know about my users because I look at our web. Well, we have web analytics. Next question is, do you look at it? That could be a no. But do you actually understand it? But even then, and I know, Laura, you've got a lot of experience in this analytics and A-B testing area, but I think even the best analytics, even A-B testing, it gives you a rather speculative view of who your users are. You can see what they're doing, but you don't really know why. So I try and get people to recognize some gaps in their own knowledge. And then often we'll mention, you know, well, why should I need usability testing? And a good response is always, well, your site will be usability tested. It just depends on whether or not you're around to see it happen. And, you know, if they actually, you know, once it is launched, there's going to be hundreds of thousands of people using it there on day one. Do you really, you know, want to wait for them to find out if it's working? And usually those kinds of things, getting people to ask some questions to themselves is a good way to subtly sell it in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, certainly from my point of view, working, I guess, on one product within one company, it's sometimes a bit of a tough sell to actually get people to focus on this, because again, when it's hard to define what user experience is, it's hard to then sell it, or it's hard to then put forward a case why it's something that we should concentrate on. So for me, it's more about a combination of looking at analytics and looking at where we can actually see improvements in conversions as a result of an improvement in user experience, but also just talking about it a lot more internally, trying to raise the awareness that this thing exists and it's important and it affects our business, and trying to get some discussions started around user experience rather than just kind of throwing around complex behavioral cognitive psychology theories and expecting people to listen.
I 100% agree with that. I think a lot of it is really about education, and it's about telling people, you know, this is what it is. Why should you be making those decisions without the input from your customers? And there's quite a few, you know, analogies that you can use and explain to people. And I've of late found people far more receptive to it, simply because you can usually take a case with to them, a case study, and say, hey, we did this usability test and it potentially either prevented us from going down a heavy investment in an IT project that potentially wasn't going to improve the customer experience anyway, or it allowed us to solve certain issues that made it a better customer experience. So I think there are quite a few like well-known case studies that, you know, that you can cite to whoever you need to actually kind of get the funding and push that point forward.
So yeah, so it comes in a kind of a cost benefit analysis. So we can kind of say, well, if you go away and invest this amount of money in usability, then the conversion is going to go up by X. Therefore, you're going to sell Y, and kind of sell it in that way. I think the conversion argument's always a good one. You can go down, but have we gotten to a situation now where, or very very recently, where UX has become the new buzzword in the internet industry and the digital industry, whereby everybody is a UX expert? I can cite a number of situations that I've been in whereby somebody's friend has told them that a green button performs better than a yellow button or a red button.
the orange button always performs better. I don't know how many emails I received to say that please change all the buttons on the site to orange because I heard that converts better, and I've heard things about, you know, how colors when they hit your eyeball and all that kind of thing. And you know, that's, I know we're talking about UX just now, but there is a place for AB and MVT, and Chris is absolutely right. You know, AB and MVT will only give you certain information. Where I see usability sits, it kind of sits in every stage in your cycle. But usability testing, really, you need to speak to people to find out the whys. Mm-hmm. AB testing, you know, it can give you the top level information. But I think as you just have a look at job descriptions just in the UX industry just now, and you'll find five different job descriptions for a UX designer. You know, yeah. I think there's still a bit of confusion as to, you know, what do people do? Some people do a bit of development. They'll do some HTML coding, they'll do some CSS and do usability. Some people have done the graphic design route of it. Some people are pure, just usability. So I think it's still a bit of an interesting space.
And the other one that's very ill-defined is, well, information architecture is another hot one in job titles.
Yeah.
And I think the cynic in me sometimes sees these job titles of information architect, experience designer slash, and sometimes they're just looking for someone who can use, someone who's good with Axure, for instance. And just because you're good at developing something in Axure, a prototyping tool, doesn't necessarily mean that you have the other skills to actually create a good user experience. You can be a super fast prototyper, but that the skills needed are much wider than that. And there's really broadly two halves. There's that whole researching into who are our users and what do they need, and then there's the evaluation and then the design stage. I sort of see three main areas, you know, researching the users. There's evaluating whatever design or prototype you have, and then there's actually the designing of it itself. And it's hard to find all of those in one package, actually, for one person.
Mm-hmm. I think as well at the moment, I know that Amazon have been sort of slowly rolling out a new lick of paint on their site globally over the last few months, and I only actually got to see it today in my account. But essentially, it's all around the edges, and the main product page stays the same. And the Amazon product page, a lot like eBay and I guess Google from a couple of years ago, seemed to be designed by testing. It seemed to be designed by consensus. It's that kind of a camel is a horse designed by committee. And sometimes I think we sometimes use, in particular, testing as a crutch, and we lack vision. And this is particularly something that we experience. We have a sister site in the US, and in the US they're heavily focused on testing. They will test everything, and they have to prove that a change in font or a change in a graphical design leads to an improvement, worst case scenario, an even keel. Whereas in the UK, I don't know if this is only true of us or this is true globally, but in the UK we seem to be a little bit more fluid, a little bit more visionary led. We have ideas and we just sort of follow them for a little while and see where they go, and don't worry so much about the specifics of testing certain things. I don't know if that's true for you guys as well, or whether it's just us.
I find that the organization I work for right now, they've just launched a new product, so really it kind of any change is, if it has even a slightly negative impact, it's a huge impact for us. So we have to be very careful about what we do put live. So we are in a process of kind of really are testing heavily, does that have a positive effect? If it doesn't, I'm not talking about tiny little text changes or font changes or small design changes. I mean the bigger structural changes. But as I said, a small negative, you know, just a couple percent is a huge thing right now for us. So I think that's where testing is really important for what we do right now.
Yeah, it's needed to get the ball rolling within an organization. They do need quantitative, you know, show me the numbers type stuff.
Definitely.
This is going to be worth it our while. And I, you know, we're fortunate to have some clients that are that way, where a 0.5% increase in their conversion rate is just a lot of money. And so, yeah, for them, it's worth it. But we also have a lot of clients that are government agencies who, well, some exceptions, they do exchange money in some areas, but mostly they're very interested in user experience and usability, invest in it, and they are not commercial organizations. They're doing it for the good of the end users, and that's kind of an ideal client to get, who is, to me, it's gratifying to see user experience translate into more money for the client, but I also like to see clients that actually have the experience of the end user as their goal.
Mm-hmm. So we've managed to sell user testing and the general looking at the whole user experience to our stakeholders, to our bosses or whatever. Now we've been asked to go forth and deal with it. So what is the UX process? Where do we start? Is it a case of just whipping out a pen and paper and start wireframing your evenings away, or what's the process? Where do we go?
For me, the first thing I do, and I might be along here, is first thing I do is look at the analytics. First thing I do is get as much data, as much MI, to build up that picture to see what's happening right now. That would be my first protocol, whether it be Google Analytics, Web Trends, Omniture, any of those packages, any internal reporting, and build up a picture of what is happening at that moment in time. So that's my first approach anyway.
Mm-hmm. We're just about to launch a major redesign. So our site at the moment, if you hop onto the site in 2 weeks' time, should look completely different in all areas. And it's sort of taken the last six to 12 months, I guess, if you include all the thinking behind it. And our process starts getting into a room, a bunch of people, and saying, wouldn't it be cool if... And just asking that question, wouldn't it be cool if, and trying to come up with some crazy ideas that won't actually get built and some less crazy ideas that actually do. But just trying to approach this as users ourselves, as Chris has been saying, put the user first and think about what their goals are and what they're trying to achieve on your site. And so we just get into a room and throw that around. And then obviously iterates and eventually becomes a site that you see. But I'm a big believer in just talking it out. A lot of user experience for me is common sense that we don't necessarily spend enough time thinking about. You can take a complicated web form, and it's common sense that you can simplify certain areas. And I think, again, very often we forget the simple things.
Yeah. I mean, it's the old one of, if common sense was so common, you know, how come we have so many uncommonly hard things to use? The way I see it, there's a an image I often refer to where it's looking at you, come up with your innovation, then you need to understand your users, or at the very least, second guess your own assumptions about those users. And then define how are we going to improve this. And it can be a radical departure from what you've done before. And that's really brave to do that. You talked about Amazon tweaking around the edges. And they're famous for, you know, continuously looking at their A-B multivariate testing and tweaking things at that level, which I think that can be great for sorting out your page level, widget level user experience, you know, button colors and things like that. But sometimes you have to think of something, what would be radically different? And my favorite radical departure is, I think of, has anyone used the site HipMonk at all? A travel site. So we've all used everything from Expedia to, Skyscanner is a great one for user experience on its site. And there's lots of them, but they all follow roughly the same model. You say, I want to go from here to there on these dates, show me your options. And that's become the de facto standard. This one does it a bit differently. It takes advantage of this common assumption we already all have about what's a timeline. And they've defined this item called pain. So when you agony, that's it, agony. So when you're judging a flight, it's not just on the time and the cost, but it's also on the agony, which is some kind of combination of the two. And they represent the results on a timeline, so you can see for each flight you're taking how long it's going to take and if there's a changeover. And because we all understand a timeline so easily, it's just, you know, there and understood. Then you can immediately see what the time is for these when they're taking off and landing, instead of trying to interpret the usual chart table of numbers of takeoff times and figure out what that all means. It's a great example of not making the user think. They can just look at this timeline and they get it. So that's HipMonk is a good example of doing a very radical departure. And of course, everyone refers to Apple with their, you know, the iPod being so different than everything else. So It's never an easy question to answer is, when do we just tweak around the edges and when is there an opportunity to do something radically different? And that's what makes this whole area so fun and exciting to work in.
Yeah, I just brought that up, actually. I really like the feature of them being able to add extra days either way, so you can search in a... It's a little thing, but being able to say, I want to go on this day and this day, but then kind of expand it by 2 or 3 days either side, so you can kind of tuck about with that. It's really nice.
There's another one sort of in a similar space called simplehoney.com, which is by the guy whose name escapes me, who was behind ICANN has cheeseburger, bizarrely enough. And Simple Honey sort of guides you through finding a hotel by asking you what's your style, what sort of holiday do you want to go on? And it kind of, from an experience point of view, I think it starts you thinking about going on that holiday right then and there. So you're entering this emotional state of, wow, I want to travel in to a boutique, a real classy boutique hotel, and I want to do it in the mountains, and I want it to be really, really luxurious. Or it might be that you want something more traditional. And you get into that state because Simple Honey is forcing you to visualize the type of holiday that you want. And then all of a sudden, it throws up a bunch of results that exactly match that. And, you know, I think that's a very clever way of putting you, it's I guess effectively priming you for the hotel that you're after.
That's nice. Bookmarking
actually,
it now.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. That's very nice.
What these ones do is that they firmly put the user's mental mindset as the core of it. So people have a hard time booking things. They don't. The leading step for creating the site is not, well, we've got this database and you can be sorting it and filtering it in this way. It is actually starting it from, how would people like to think about trying to find a flight? How would they like to visualize that? How would they like to find a hotel? And they're using that as their starting point. And it's very hard to come up with that blank slate and start from scratch, and they've been very brave and hopefully very successful in doing that.
What I do like here, and I think we've talked a lot about innovation and things just before there, that the site there, Simple Honey, is something that you can actually use and useful, and you can see a customer use it a lot of the time. You know, is to get in a room and come up with these great big ideas. You know, I've been in situations where you think, hey, this would be a really great idea, shorten a form in this way or present it in this way, and that will work really, really well. And you get to it and the customer goes, yeah, that's cool. Would you use it? No. So it's getting that balance, I think, right, between like real innovation, something that's really going to add value to your customer and to your user, and they're going to use it, and not something that's quite cool and it looks good, but in actual fact, it doesn't actually add anything to what the customer's trying to do and what they're trying to achieve there. But what I think Simple Honey does excellently well there is they're helping a customer or helping their user find a hotel which suits their needs. So they've matched innovation to the task very nicely.
Yeah, I think you come across that quite often, or certainly I do anyway, in forms, application forms and things like that. And, the product owners or something like that, or the stakeholders, are wanting this to be the fanciest, most wow factor form ever that's going to, blow everybody's minds. And at the end of the day, the customer just wants a simple form that gets them from point A to point B in the quickest and simplest way possible. I think there's always kind of battling off, we want to be industry leading in this beautiful, beautiful form design, against, no, let's just make it good for the customer.
I'm as guilty of that as anyone. In the current version of our site, we had some fancy form validation where little bubbles float in next to the field and tell you what's wrong in lovely language. And in the new version of the site, we ditched it all, and we just have a very simple message under the form field telling you what's wrong if there's an error. Because I think you're right. I think sometimes with something like a form, particularly a complicated form, we don't need to start adding bells and whistles to it to make it look pretty or delightful. I think forms are a utilitarian thing, and they need to function as such.
There's a time and place to be trying to be interesting and innovative. I often tell clients it's time to sort of turn off the branding and turn off the distractions when it gets to forms, because the user is often sitting there with a mouse in one hand and a credit card in the other hand, and they're a little bit feeling on the back foot, and anything that's a bit distracting to them or acting a bit different, the interaction design isn't probably going to do more harm than good. So innovate with care and with a lot of evidence that it's a good thing. And there's a lot of innovations in forms, certainly the inline validation type thing, and inline formatting instructions over the past 5 years, that's become a very common thing, and that's been a good thing for the user. But you definitely take it very carefully and cautiously there.
Have you guys ever used personas when you're dealing with usability, or rather user experience or something like that, to kind of help visualize your end users? Is that something that's part of the process you would use?
I've personally set up personas, and right now we actually have a global, for the global company, we have global personas which we use for all kind of aspects of testing and market research as well, and trying to match that up. So we definitely use personas in what we do.
Sorry, to explain what personas is, I just realised there may be some listeners who don't understand what personas are. Basically, whereby you kind of invent a character that matches a segment of your user base, your customer or something like that. You give them a name, something. You usually would give them a photograph that kind of goes along with it, and give them a few attributes, like this is maybe their salary bracket, this is the technology they like to use, this is the type of shopping that they do, this is the type of shops that they go in. You might even go so far as, this is the type of the music they have, this is how many kids they've got, and so on and so forth. So it's basically creating a character that you can then imagine is using your website.
Yeah, there's a really good resource, if people haven't seen it before, Aaron Walter's website, aaronwalter.com/design-personas. He covers it in his book, Designing for Emotion, one of the Book Apart books, but you can actually download his design persona templates for free. They're really good. They just sort of talk you through some basic questions about your users, and you sort of fill it in, and you end up with these great personas that you can then refer to when you're asking UX questions.
The one thing I would be careful of would be that you you actually do know who your customers and who your users are, because it's quite easy to to suggest, well, I it's this type of person, or it's this, this character that will be using your site, and in actual fact, that isn't who uses your site. You might think that I worked for a footwear retailer a few years back, and they thought that their user was 18 to 25, and in actual fact, it wasn't. It was 35 to 45, So it is making sure that you do understand who your users and who your customers who are using your site actually are before you create the persona.
That's a really good point, Laura, because I've certainly seen a lot of clients that do what I call creating personas out of wishful thinking rather than hard evidence. you can't have that. And it's so hard to keep your personas clean from the internal perceptions. We all know that's the main role of personas. One of the main roles is to give a vehicle, a prism through which you can actually, you know, again, empathize, to use overuse that word tonight, with your end users and trying to imagine how they'd think and react to the content and things you're putting on there. It does take so much. The mindset of the company really depends. Certain companies, I know people like the BBC and other broadcasters, because it's in their nature to try and think about their viewers. They love personas and they're creating personas about people, you know, consuming content and stuff. Other times, I know other companies that are very cut and dry. Personas, it's a bit wiffy-waffy. It's just Barbies for grown-ups. Now, let's just get on with creating the site. And so the mindset of the company makes a huge difference. And I personally get very excited when I can detect that the client will not only benefit from using personas, but they have an appetite for it and that it'll actually be useful for them. Because a lot of times personas get made and never get used, and they just kind of rot away. So maintaining your personas is the other important thing to do as well.
The one thing that I'm kind of guilty of at the moment, we, as I said, we have our global personas. But that is based on our customer data who've actually purchased with us. What it doesn't tell us is the customers and the users who didn't purchase with us. So we've created this global persona on the customers who liked our offer, not the ones who didn't like it, who we didn't engage with. And the question would be is why were we not matching up to their expectations? So it really is, you have to be very careful in your persona creation.
Yeah.
Cool. So we could talk about this all night, and I'm sure if this was a double episode, we could quite easily fill that. But if the listener just wanted to learn a little bit more about the subject, about anything we've discussed here, anything from usability, user experience, UI design, accessibility, or anything like that, or information architecture, can you give any recommendations as to places they might go to look, blogs, books they could read, community groups they could join, any other recommendations?
Yeah, websites, Boxes and Arrows, especially if you're into information architecture, great repository there.
There's, I actually would even suggest going on to a lot of usability consultants sites as well. A lot of times they'll publish white papers, articles, reviews of other sites that you can actually kind of see the format that a user experience professional will go through to analyze a site, so you can actually start to pick out areas, you know, that you should be focusing on when you're coming to audit something.
In terms of getting inspiration as well, I like littlebigdetails.com. I like Shots of Things That Work, which is thegodfounder.com. And also a good UX Mag Online is just uxmag.com. That's worth sticking in your RSS reader.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you should collect all these, the show notes.
Yeah. We'll put all these links in the show notes. And actually, if there's anything that you guys think of after the fact, we can pop some of them in as well if there's any of the links.
Sure.
Yeah. Paul, the other one, which I know Chris used to be head of, is the Scottish chapter anyway, is Usability Professionals Association, who will have regional meetings and get-togethers and talks and seminars on the topic. And usually students can get a registry for going in, so they can be really good areas and sources for information as well. And also just a networking opportunity to meet up with people in the industry. You'll tend to find that usability people, I always get, you know, I go into meetings and I always get told, can you slow down talking, because you get really fast when you're really passionate about talking about something. So I think everyone's the same. You know, I go off, like, you know, the clappers kind of talking about usability. But you tend to find people in user experience are very passionate about what they do, and they'll be more than happy to take time and explain and talk you through and point people in the right direction. So things like Usability Professional Association are great events to go along to and meet up with some other people who would more than happily direct you in the right areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And if you need real inspiration, I was lucky enough to go to the conference this year in Las Vegas, and that was incredibly inspiring. You know, some of the great and good of user experience and usability were there and talking, and come out of that week incredibly inspired. So, yeah, it's a great organization.
Great. Should probably also mention, Claire Mundy was due to be on this podcast as well tonight, but she unfortunately had to call off last minute. And she runs a LinkedIn group called UX Scotland that meets in Edinburgh. I think the plan is monthly, and the first meeting is actually Wednesday past when this podcast comes out. So if you join that group on LinkedIn, you'll be able to pick up with them as well. But that's another place for good networking and meeting up with like-minded individuals and that. So this section of the web show is brought to you by Pusher. If you're developing or thinking of developing a web or mobile app that has live updating content, activity streams, chat, real-time blogging, second screen apps, multiplayer games, and much more, then you need Pusher. Pusher is an HTML5 WebSocket-powered service that makes adding these sort of features easy. Pusher removes the headache of configuring and scaling real-time infrastructure so that you can concentrate on developing features. If you could head over to pusher.com/webshow, that's webshow on Word, and sign up for a free sandbox plan. Then when you're ready to upgrade, you just enter the promotional code in all capital letters, webshow_bootstrap, and you'll be able to claim your free 3-month bootstrap plan. So if you can head on over to pusher.com/webshow, let them know we sent you. Pusher support British Tech Network's web show, and would love you to support them. So thank you very much. Right, on now to the listener questions. Now, we've only got three tonight because I wasn't going to throw any SEO or development-related questions at you guys necessarily, so we'll stay on the usability one. So the first one comes from Ian Wilson. So thank you very much for Ian for emailing this in. I work for a small firm with a small web budget. I really want to user test my website. What tools are available for me to do it myself or to get the required user data for my website for less than $1,000? So have you got any thoughts for Ian?
There's a couple I've heard of and have been recommended but haven't personally used. The first is 5-second test, which is where you upload a screen grab of your website, and you pay a certain amount, and users will go along, look at it, and you get to ask them 5 questions. So the question might be something like, what do you think the point of this page is, or how do you think that you progress through this form? It's really, really cheap. I think it's like $50 for their middle of the road plan, and a couple of people have said good things about that. And then the other one was usertesting.com. again, a couple of people have recommended this to me. Slightly more expensive, but you give them your URL, you ask a couple of questions, and you get actual user feedback sent back to you.
Okay.
Yeah, those are good. There's really in the past few years a whole slew of tools have come out. Things like usertesting.com is probably the highest profile of one of the remote unmoderated tools where you can get 15, 20-minute videos of people using your site. And it is, you give them the tasks and you get to hear them talking through the use of it. Of course, because you're not there, you can't have the proper conversation and drill down and a little bit more into it. But it will be for that situation, that would be a really good thing to do. There's quite a few others, Feedback Army, Open Hallway, What Users Do in the UK. There's quite a few of those, and it's good.
Chris, do you know if in usertesting.com you can actually select the type of person that looks at the site?
Yeah. I think that's where they're trying to become more. They're trying to improve. They used to be usertesting.com used to just get Americans, and I think now they certainly do have a global panel. I've talked to them recently, so they're all realizing that people are wanting a variety. You probably can't get very specific user types, and this is where we've had incredibly difficult recruitment challenges in the past, and you won't find this very specific type of user that you might if you're doing medical research or anything like that. But for your general, if it's a very public consumption general website and you're on a very limited budget, that can serve you very well.
The other one that kind of offers a similar service is actually Visual Website Optimizer, which primarily is an AB and MVT solution, but it does offer remote usability testing as well. And that's really inexpensive. I think for the lowest plan, it's like $49, and you can utilize their testing panel. Another couple of resources I've used in the past, one would be WebSort, which is an online card sorting activity. So if you're looking to do an IA study, You can do that quite quickly and easily and send out a link to a customer database that you might have to ask them to group your content together. That's now owned by a company called UXPunk, who, great name for a company. They also have another company they've merged together, and the other side of their company is called plainframe.com, and that is actually remote usability testing of navigation menus. So you can actually test your IE within the navigation to see how it will work. So they're two really inexpensive tools that can be used as well.
Yeah, along those lines, there's some from the folks in New Zealand, Optimal Sort and Chalkmark, come from the same type of thing, where you can get remote feedback either on the organization for creating an IA or testing the IA, which is TreeJack, and then Chalkmark is just checking out where people would click on certain parts to your site. And you know, they on their own, they may not solve all your problems, but they'll give you good, useful insights enough to push your design along.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another one that's not necessarily a user, so for a kind of test for users, but being that Laura mentioned MVT stuff, and, well, it's more AB, but of course there's Google Website Optimizer as well there, which is a free resource from Google for just getting AB testing.
Well, that's now, as of last week, I think, Website Optimizer has actually been... it's been
part of analytics. It's merged.
It's now part of analytics. So now, if you go into your product interface in Google, you won't see it. You could click on it, and you won't be able to get anywhere. If you are looking for it, it's so much easier than it ever was. It's now actually just in your content tab in analytics under experiments. And what's great about it now is you only need to put your tracking code on your testing page, not on the conversion page. Actually uses your goals and conversion metrics that you've set up within Google Analytics. So a lot of times people couldn't do A/B testing because the conversion page is maybe in a secure site, and with IT resource it's difficult, but with them pulling that to the non-secure side, so you can actually do it on the front end, so it's a lot quicker to do. So it's definitely a great resource.
Very cool. The next question comes in from Anne McCoom. Have you ever used tools like Tea Leaf or Crazy Egg, and what are your thoughts on them? Now, as far as I'm aware, albeit I've only ever read about these two, I've never actually used them. They're both quite different tools, so they're not a kind of a comparison. But have you guys ever used either of these, and do you have any thoughts on them?
I'm about to install Crazy Egg.
Right.
I'm about to install Crazy Egg. It's very inexpensive, and it gives... This is a terrible thing to admit, but it gives you the kind of visual reporting that senior management kind of crave. So,
makes pretty pictures. A heat map. Ooh.
Yep, exactly. That's it. That's exactly it. They like the heat maps and click
maps.
That's
cool.
we signed up to Crazy Egg about a year ago and used it on a few different pages on the site. And you're absolutely right. It just gave us wonderfully pretty pictures, which told us what we already knew. So I think it's definitely interesting, and it's definitely interesting to see maybe some parts of the web of a web page that are being clicked on that you maybe thought you didn't think were, and this is kind of leads us into the next question, but it also shows you how far down a page people will scroll and click and interact. So it's interesting, but I'm not necessarily convinced it's essential.
Yeah, I agree. It'll give you evidence of what people do. It's kind of like analytics on steroids. It'll show you where people moved on the page and stuff. But, you know, I'm just looking at the Crazy Egg site, and they've got, you know, 88% correlation, apparently, between mouse and eye movement. Now, I know we haven't talked about eye tracking within this, but if anyone has seen a real eye tracking session and looking at the eye gaze of a plot, it is your eyes all over the place and dashing all over the place. And I definitely would question this 88% correlation between mouse and eye movement. So, yeah, I think it's a bit of a flawed tool.
Okay. Exactly. And when you see the when you see eye tracking studies, and what I think Chris would probably agree with me here, is that, it tells you the what's. It doesn't tell you why. It doesn't tell you why you're not able to speak to your users and your customers and ask, why did you click on that button and not on that one after the fact, you know? So again, it's kind of, for me, the only reason I am installing it is literally because I think one of the senior managers heard about a heat map and read something somewhere, and is kind of demanding it, and you know, our analytics just outlay us so much. So
yeah. So that's crazy egg. But has anybody done anything with tea leaf? Has anybody got any opinions on that?
No, never used it. Talk to the people from Tea Leaf and have a bit of an understanding, but not enough to really have a informed.
Yeah, I saw a presentation from them a few years ago now down at an IMRG conference, but again, I've not had any.
Okay.
Interaction.
Okay, no problem. I do know that there is another tool like Tea Leaf. It's a very, very similar offering, and I'm only mentioning it because the guys from this company are actually coming on to our analytics show in a couple of weeks, so that's the only reason I'm kind of mentioning them. But ServiceTick does a very similar thing at Tea Leaf, and as I understand it, there's quite a dramatic difference in price. But as I say, I'm only mentioning it because one of the guys from ServiceTick's coming on the show in a couple of weeks. So. Okay, so I hope that answers your question, Anne. If you have any follow-up questions or anything like that, feel free to pop them back in and we'll see if we can get them answered for you. And finally this evening, a question comes from Phil Edwards. My client regularly wants items and key buttons within the screen without scrolling. Is this as important now as with many screen sizes? As with many screen sizes, so I assume that means as in a lot of different viewports and everything like that. And if not, what arguments could I give to my clients to request this? So I'm assuming this is this old debate about the fold and being above the fold and scrolling and everything like that. So what's our thoughts on this?
I think it depends on your site, in all honesty. I think it's a big thing, depends on your site. Personally, I believe that just with the growth of people using touchscreen devices, people are far more used to scrolling as it used to be. But I think it's site dependent and your structure dependent. You know, it has to fit in with the structure. There's no point in putting a button at the top of the page if it doesn't fit there, if it doesn't look right there, and if a customer is actually inevitably going to miss it, you know. So I think it is dependent.
Yeah, this is sort of moving into the realms of IA and content strategy. I think that, you know, from my point of view, of course there's a fold. The fold is at the bottom of the viewport. The only problem is we just don't know where that is. So I think all you can do is think about good content strategy and just think what's the important information for the user, and that's probably going to go at the top of the page. And then as you scroll down the page, either the information is becoming less important to the user or it's becoming less important from a business point of view. In other words, it doesn't impact conversions as much.
Yeah, I think it is a bit of a fallacy that people don't scroll down. They do, and it does help if you can have your page designed so that it – in a way, whatever's below the fold is kind of peeking above. But of course, you never know where that fold is going to lie, depending on the screen resolution. So it's probably not worth worrying about what's above and below the fold, and more just as we're hearing, trying to think of what's important and gravitate that up towards the top of the page. And it's more likely to be seen even without scrolling, you know, as Richard was saying.
Mm. Okay, okay. Grant, so that's a list of questions. If you've got any further questions about user experience or anything like that, or anything else to do with the web, please feel free to email them in. I'll give the contact details at the end of the show. So this podcast and all the others would not be possible without UK2.net. They've kept the British Tech Network afloat for over 3 years, and they're brilliant, and you should use them. We've got a whole pile of voucher codes for various discounts and services at UK2. So if you head on over to the British Tech Network site, so that's britishtechnetwork.com, and you click on the sponsors link, you'll then see information on all the different vouchers codes that we have available. If you then click on the link on that page, that'll take you over to UK2. It'll also tell them that we sent you. And if you just fill your basket up with everything you need, you pop in all your voucher codes. And some of the voucher codes actually completely, bring your basket right down to zero. They completely remove any charge on some of the services. So if you could just head over there, fill your basket up, check out with your voucher codes and everything like that, and that we're forever grateful. As a side thing, whenever you're logging into your UK2 account, if you could come through the British Tech Network first, just so that they know that we sent you. So that's it. British Tech Network, we absolutely adore UK2, and hopefully they will continue supporting us for many, many moons yet. So UK2, they support British Tech, and you should support them. So thank you very much. So finally this evening, do we have any picks? I'm going to leave Laura to last because I kind of threw her the fact that she had to have a pick just at the beginning of this show. So I'm going to give her a minute to have a wee rake about and see if she can find something. So meantime, Chris, do you have anything for us?
Yeah, the cool things on the web, things, I suppose I've given mine, and Hipmunk, I think, is kind of cool. Right. But I've always been a big fan of any kind of rich internet applications. So I can't think of any at the moment, but just a great RIA or information visualization that reveals things in an elegant way. I love it. I can't think of one at the moment, I'm afraid.
Well, I think Hipmunk was very cool, so we'll accept that as your cool thing for this evening.
Thanks.
Richard, do you have anything for us?
Yeah, I'm going to throw a curveball here. We talked earlier on about the things we should be reading and looking at to be inspired. I think it's great to look beyond websites and look into product design. So I'm going to nominate Ouya, which is O-U-Y-A, Ouya.tv, which is a new video games console. It's due out early next year, but you can pre-order it now. It's $109, which is really cheap, and it's running a modified version of the Android operating system. So what it's allowing you to do is to bring all the Android games from the Google Play Store onto your TV, and it comes with a custom controller. A bunch of developers are rewriting some Android games specifically for the telly. It looks great, it's cheap, it's a really, really good looking device, so I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, I actually have pre-ordered that as well, and I love it that they've actually got some really good, like, high-profile games, so it's actually going to potentially be kind of rivaling, maybe not quite the PS4 or the Xbox 720, but it could potentially be rivaling the Wii very, very soon, so yeah, I'm looking forward to that as well. Should be noted, I think you have to pay an extra $20 if you are buying it from the UK, because there's
That's
a shipment
right.
charge as well, isn't there? Yeah, but yeah, no, I'd agree, it's awesome. I'm very much looking forward to that arriving as well. Very good, very good. Laura, have you managed to dig something up yet?
Well, the only thing is not cool and it's not really new, but I can't live without one tool, and it's Snagit, and it's a TechSmith tool. And Paul, you'll know that I'm a big fan of Snagit.
Yes, I do.
I hacked on it about for a long time. It's basically just, again, as I say, it's a screen grabbing tool, but it's got elements of kind of Photoshop in there, and it allows you to take cool things off online. And save them and mess around with them, and you know, see how you can adapt them and take your pages and mock things up very quickly if you're doing small changes. So I would say it's neither cool nor new, but it's something I find very useful on a day-to-day basis.
No, I love that. And TechSmith, friends of the network, they very kindly sponsored our birthday bash at the beginning of the summer. So yeah, actually, everybody that came along to the bash this year got a voucher, a free copy of Snagit and Camtasia from TechSmith.
Oh, another great tool, Snagit. Well, TechSmith obviously make Mori as well great usability software. So they are a wonderful company. I would definitely say that.
Yes, yes, yeah. We love TechSmith here. Very good. Very good. So finally, where can we get you on the web? So sort of for Chris, where's the best place to get a hold of you, sir?
Okay, I'm Chris at uservision.co.uk. And as you can probably guess, the website is uservision.co.uk.
Yes. Cool. Richard, where can we get you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. It's just at Richard Shepherd, and also richardshepherd.com is where I go to rant. So you can find me there as well.
Very good. Now, I'm going to come round to Laura, but I don't believe you're a Twitterer, Laura. So
I beg to differ.
Oh, what, really? Wow.
I ventured in the one thing to say about me is I am not a big fan of social media. I'm one of very, very, very few UX people who do not like social media that much. But I finally gave in. So I do have a Twitter account just to follow what's late. That's actually another tip, is really getting on Twitter and having a look at latest posts and things, because in all honesty, it is a great resource for people posting new latest developments and articles and things on Twitter. So I'm at UX Laura on Twitter.
Very good. And sorry?
And mine is at C Rourke, as you mentioned in the beginning. I'll start following you, Laura, now that you're on Twitter.
There you go. There's not very much on there, Chris. I'm not going to lie to you. But, you know, you can tweet me as, you know.
Definitely.
I know what it's information.
Like, yeah, when you first sign up, you feel like you're shouting out into an empty room, so you need followers. I'll be glad to be one.
Well, yeah, so there's two things. You know, I'll talk about UX, and I'll also talk about cake. So two of my very great passions.
And surely shoes as well. So like, what was that, sorry? You're kind of a three-hit pony. You've got shoes as well. Shoes, cake, and UX.
Shoes, cake, and UX. Yeah. I mean, what else do you need in life?
Very good. And you can get me on Twitter. I'm at Paul Wheatley. You can also follow the network on Twitter. That's at British Tech News. And as I mentioned before, if you want to email us with any questions, any comments, anything like that about the show, please do so by emailing us britishtechnews@gmail.com. Also, if you like what you've heard, I would love if you could head on over to iTunes and give us a review and some stars. They really help our ratings. We're actually doing very, very well in iTunes just now, so your ratings and your stars are really helping that, so it'd be great if that could continue. And we will be back in 2 weeks with another web show, and in 2 weeks' time the topic will be choosing the right CMS. So we've got a really good panel of folk coming on to talk about a number of different CMSs and a bit of a discussion about which one's the best one to go for your organisation. So that's us for tonight. I hope you've enjoyed the discussion. Thank you very much to the panel. It's been a pleasure having you on, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Thank you very much. Good night.